is to the governor's staff, and they get special assignments. And I wasn't quite sure what I'd be doing, so I went over there and ended up working for the Commissioner of Corrections, which wasn't at all what I really had in mind. I thought I'd maybe be working in computers or something like that, which I'd been doing, and all of a sudden found myself working in a field I didn't know anything about. And I really got a shock, because I found out my job was to set up an ombudsman program. And an ombudsman is a very rare thing in prisons, and has been for years, but it's becoming, I think, more so now. There's quite a few of them around. And I ended up helping write the legislation and actually get the program started, and ended up in the prisons, all of the prisons in Minnesota, actually being an ombudsman, which was really a shock and a different kind of thing for someone like myself, who had been operating most of the time in middle-class white suburbia, ended up in prisons and getting a whole new look at life. So after that, I've been up here several times and gave some seminars on my experiences, and we talked a lot about that. And after the six-month period, then I chaired a committee for the state legislature in Minnesota that looked at the entire prison system and studied the kinds of problems they were having, and we came up with recommendations on how to change the whole system, and those recommendations are now going into effect and have been for the last few years. So I got a chance to look at not only corrections in the state of Minnesota, but all over the country, because we studied the problems in all of the states, and even in parts of Europe. Some of the best systems in the world are in Europe, particularly Sweden. Had a chance to look at those and bring back all kinds of ideas and put them together. So I've had a little bit of background, just enough to make me dangerous. I'm not an expert. I've had some funny experiences and some sort of sad experiences. Mr. Savvides, Ellis Savvides here, has spent a long time in corrections. I don't know how long you spent. I didn't want to ask you that because I wasn't sure you'd tell me. But
well, I can say briefly a little bit, because I may be doing a lot of talking a little bit about my background. I spent around 30 years in prisons, I guess 5 of those years in jails in California. I started out as an officer in one of the Southern California prisons and ended up assistant to the Director of Corrections in California. The last 7 years being more or less troubleshooter. Whenever we have troubles in our prisons, the director would send me out to take a look, stay there for a week. And so the gamut run from everything. I have some, I had a degree when I started in criminology, then I have some graduate work in education and psychology. And being a sensitive kind of a guy, I was in a way, in retrospect, in the wrong business, because prisons are very tough life in prisons. Life in prisons brings you, in a half an hour you can see a whole family's life. It's sort of like if you cut a person, dissect them, that's how intense sometimes the issues and the problems come. And so now I'm retired, 5 years. I don't know anything about prisons.
Well, I think we're lucky to get you to talk to us today. That's one of the reasons.
If you have any questions about criminology and punishment and all that, I'll give you whatever I have in terms of experience. And that's my conviction, not I don't represent an official body.
How many of you have been involved in corrections in any way? I know some of you have, inside or out.
I had a parolee working for me. I sponsored a parolee at one time.
Did you? But, anybody else have anything to do? Yes, sir? What were you doing?
I've been in correction 25 years.
You have? Where?
In juvenile work.
In what state?
In Washington.
Yeah, they have...
I was the superintendent of Washington.
Ah, good.
Probation work for 19 years.
Right.
Parole work.
Right. Right. Anybody else?
I visit people in prison.
Yeah, I bet you do. Yeah. Right. I've often wondered what kind of conception people have of prison that haven't been there. How many of you have been inside of a prison? Okay, well, so there is. Just, yeah. Yeah, I won't ask you why. No, the next question I won't ask. No. Yeah. All right. Maybe we should have you ask some questions that you have about prison. There's a lot of misconceptions, and there's a lot of talk about prisons being a microcosm of society, things like that. And we could get into all kinds of things like that, but I'd rather play to what your interests are rather than what we think they might be. What kind of questions
I'm
do you have?
I'm interested in what they're doing in Sweden, which you said was one of the most advanced countries.
Oh, yes. Okay, I'm going to have to go back and fishing in my memory, but as I was looking at it about 3 years ago. Anybody else that's been dealing with them, chime in. The things I remember about what they were doing is that they studied different problems very carefully and had a lot of research going on, and practical kinds of research. Like they'd study a problem like the sex offender, and they'd try to find something that would work in curing that kind of problem. And then they tended to build an institution just for that problem. And then they would isolate sex offenders. I remember them because that's a severe problem in society that we're not handling very well yet, even though we have an answer for it, pretty much. But in Sweden, as I remember, they tend to put them in an institution by themselves and treat them, or at least keep them there and treat them more or less humanely, and separate them from other kinds of problems. I know that they have some large industrial institutions where they concentrate on work and teaching people to work. So they've combined research with actual implementation, and they have small corrections units all over the country concentrating on different kinds of problems.
Do their statistics bear out that their system is better than anybody else?
They seem to, although I have a tough time with the statistics because nothing really works out too well anywhere when you get grinding out the statistics. But yes, they think that they're having very good results. Yes, yes, sir.
The basic question that's always bothered me is, what percentage of the people can really be rehabilitated? That is, you can read articles that say, we're wasting our time. The habitual criminal, nothing can do but protect society from him, and then we should just have a warehouse. On the other hand, it's pretty hard. Everybody gets in jail, assuming that someone can be rehabilitated. So having met some of these people face to face, what's your gut feel? How many people could successfully be rehabilitated, and how many is going to have to be kept locked up?
Yep, I got an answer for that, but I'd like to toss that out. Ellis,
well,
first.
My outlook, because I've been in prison 30 years, maybe it may be very pessimistic. It will be pessimistic because that's the way I feel. In the first place, there's no rehabilitation. There is no process of rehabilitation. I spent 30 years rehabilitating people in prisons, and I find out that there is no process of rehabilitation. Because when you're talking about rehabilitation, you're talking about changing human behavior. And when you're talking about changing human behavior, you look at psychology, psychiatry, or religion. And nowhere can you find a specified process by which, if you apply it, you're going to change human behavior. So my answer to you is that there is no process of rehabilitation. On the other hand, we who are in the business sell that to the public and to the legislature all the time to get money to run at least humane and decent facilities. On the other hand, how many recover? By and large, 50% of the people that come to prison don't come back. Whether we have programs or not, it's just like psychotherapy is effective for 65% of the people that take psychotherapy. Also, people who are in trouble who do not take psychotherapy, 65% recover.
It's with this in mind that they recognize there's no treatment in prison, that the whole new direction is what they call the determinate sentence.
Yes.
Yes. Indeterminate, which has been the common practice, and indeterminate based on treatment. Determinate is not, it's treatment based on punishment.
Have you gone to determinate in Washington?
Not in the, they just changed the law for juvenile.
Uh-huh.
And it's based on determinate sentence.
Right.
It's reversed the whole juvenile process of treatment versus you're punished for what you did. And the kind of crime you do is then determines how long you stay in the
prison. Yeah.
But they didn't change the law in terms of adults.
We just moved in California on determinate sentence for adults.
They changed it.
That's a tremendous change.
Yep.
It's all based on punishment.
Yeah, and it indicates a sort of reversal of what we have done in 30 years. When the indeterminate sentence came in, they said, this is the thing that's really a new thrust in corrections, and we're going to save everybody. And now 30 years later or more, whenever, we find that we go back. The same thing with the juvenile process. When the juvenile process started back in Boston someplace, the juvenile court originally, established. We had a whole legal system based on juveniles, the handling of the juveniles. Now the trend is to say, we have to hold them responsible just as though they are adults, because they shoot you down just as cold as an adult, or they're more destructive.
But in so, juvenile field, they separated out the delinquent from the dependent.
Well, that's a difference.
It's all in one law.
Did they do away with the parole boards then?
No, they didn't. Because they didn't change the law in terms of adults in this state.
Oh, I see. But they did in California then, and I suppose they did.
No, there is some kind of a board. The parole board authority is abolished, but there's another kind of board that reviews the cases of men for, they have a, what they call good time. And they are not only sentenced to so many years minus the good time that they may earn by good behavior. And I think that board reviews the case.
They still have some of that.
Yes.
Oh, I just remembered one thing. I want to digress for a minute. If any of you are here to see the movie The Wrong Box, it's not going to be shown right now. That's tomorrow night. We just had that in the title. If you didn't hear it at lunch, I don't think anybody is here, but just in case. Maybe we should mention what indeterminate sentencing is to make sure that everybody understands that, because it's kind of a complex idea, although it appears to be simple on the surface.
Well, indeterminate sentence in brief terms is that the judge says, I find you guilty and sentence as prescribed by law, which may mean 1 to 5 or 1 to life. It's indeterminate as to how many years you're going to be in prison as the judge invokes the sentence. And then in California, we have the adult authority, which reviews the man's case every year and then sets a parole date, anywhere within those limits, 1 to 5 or 1 to life. By and large, it was sort of became mechanical after a while.
The parole board sets a minimum.
Yes.
And then the maximum.
But now at a determinate sentencing, when you go in, you know exactly how long you're going to stay there. One of the interesting aspects of that was the way that it changed the so-called rehabilitation programs. And I think, didn't it grow out of the fact that there were so many people trying to use rehabilitation programs as a way to work their way out of the system, to con the parole board into letting them out early? So now when someone goes into prison, they know they're going to be there for 24 months or 5 years, and they can choose to sit and not do anything. At least that's the way it's been explained to me in Minnesota. Or they can work into a rehabilitative process if they want to, but their choice for rehabilitation has got nothing to do with their getting out. And there's been terrible arguments back and forth, and both sides sound just terrifically right when you listen to them. It's one of those arguments. Yes, sir?
You said with determinate sentencing, they know when they go in how long they're going to be.
Yes, right.
Just to be a little bit humorous about it, seems to me they know before they plan the crime, if they get caught, how long they're going to be in. And that's supposed to be the deterrent.
That's part of it, too, yes. Yeah. That's part of the whole thing. They know that if they murder somebody, it's going to be, I don't know what it is, but it's... Right now it's 18 and a half years under the indeterminate. Yes, sir?
What does this do with plea bargaining?
I'm not sure. What does anyone know what that does?
The prosecuting attorney will plea bargain with the defense attorney, says, if you will admit guilt in a lesser crime, then they get off the hook.
I should think that'd be more effective, though.
Gets the case taken care of.
Yeah.
It's the greater crime. It's much harder. You have to go through jury hearing and a lot of expense and time. So plea bargaining is a very common practice, which is unfortunate. There's a lot of good criminals that say difficult criminals get off the hook.
So this determinate sentence didn't stop that at all, right?
No.
It might have made it more effective more appealing.
Plea bargaining defines what the crime was, and once you define the crime, then the determinate sentence matches up with the defined crime.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's much more.
The definition of the crime can vary greatly depending on what the prosecuting attorney wants to come up with.
Back to your question about the rehabilitation, that really is an interesting thing. In all of the programs that we studied around the country and in Europe, almost everybody said the same thing. We're not having much success. And a lot of it was because of the environment of the prison itself, where it was hard to get programs going and all kinds of things like that. But as you said, Ellis, things just didn't work. And after 20 or 30 years, you become disillusioned. We did find, though, a lot of individual programs that seemed to have a lot of promise. And they were new, but for some reason or another, they were getting hung up somewhere, and they'd get stopped. I'll go back to sex offenders again. This is one of my favorites because it's an interesting, not because I'm interested in sex offenders. it's one of my favorites for another reason. One of the first things I learned when you get into a prison, that the sex offender, I would guess, is probably the lowest animal in the prison, I would guess, isn't he?
He doesn't command too much respect.
No, not from anybody.
Even from those people.
Yeah, and so he really, really lives a miserable existence there. There's another characteristic. They usually get out, almost always get out, and when they do, they repeat right away. There's not much time goes by before they do something again and get caught. It's sort of a cyclical affair. Every 4 to 5 months, they do something, they get caught, put in for a year or two, and out again. And you're pretty well sure they're going to repeat. There have been some programs that have worked very well in curing sex offenders that are pretty severe, and I found one that was working well and did a study of it, followed up sex offenders that have been treated for about 2 years, and found that only 3 out of 60 had repeated. And that was phenomenal results, because usually 60 out of 60 repeat if you don't do anything for them. It doesn't have that effect what you usually have, where a lot of people get cured whether you do something or not. Here they don't usually get cured.
This is tremendous. If you got three out of 60
3 out of 60 did repeat. The rest
did
of them
not violate. Well, you got tremendous effect.
Well, I really got excited about those findings. It was part of, at the end of this committee I was running, the hearings, and everybody on the committee thought it was great, and they were going to put it into the law.
How many years clear? Two years clear.
And so we got it into the legislature, and then it got ground up in the committees, and a lot of moral problems with the treatment, because it wasn't all the kinds of things that people thought they should be doing, and the darn thing died, and it never did get implemented. And there were several other programs like that, where they where we found things would work, but they just aren't being implemented. So in my experience, when I came away from the whole thing and have been watching the implementation, most of the things that we recommended are being implemented, but they're brick and mortar type things. But when we really got into programmatic stuff, none of it got implemented. Not a bit.
It was so touchy that they wouldn't go.
Oh, there's a little pornography, semi-pornography, and stuff involved, you know, and it's a retraining, a sexual retraining kind of program to try to get people.
Is this program at St. Peter at security?
No, it was one in St. Paul at the Center for Behavior Modification. That was
it's the same thing.
Yeah, same kind of program. Yeah. They're still using it around the state, but it's not being, you know, not really being totally effectively operated. And the decision really, in my mind, came down to we'd rather have people out doing these kinds of things than really having them go through some things that are socially objectable. They still aren't really acceptable to society.
The book and the movie Clockwork Orange dealt with this kind of conditioning.
Yeah.
Was that the same conditioning they were using?
Somewhat the same, yeah. Well, there was a little aversive conditioning, not too much.
No? Aversive conditioning?
Aversive, negative conditioning.
Yes, yes.
Not too much of that, no.
How did it work, Nick? How was the behavior modification set up for these people?
Well, the part that was objectionable is that there was a surrogate involved. And the surrogate was, for a male, was a woman whose job was to teach him normal sexual activities. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of people couldn't buy.
But besides that, there were not objections to the
rest of the program.
Basic,
no problem.
Behavioral modification.
No.
A philosophy of behavioral modification.
No, not at all. No, in fact, there's quite a bit of that used in Minnesota. It's quite popular.
At security hospital, when you get the criminal money, then you're bottom of the system. In fact, anyone now, since they're no good deal, they're running. They have the road to St. Peter is being worn out.
Yeah.
But part of their program, they're using some of these same films, but they're also getting co-eds from the Gustavus Adolphus in Mankato State to come up to the guys at the security hospital. The security hospital is really a good place to be, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried to shut it down once and almost got tossed out.
I got
politically, that didn't work too well.
With a whole bunch of people, and nothing went out of my mind. But That's prison. But you know, the guys in there, you know, they have these girls come in and say, you know, when I go to check in, I just want to lie.
Yeah.
And all that thing. But they're having somewhere.
A lot of this, all of this stuff's governed by politics, that, of course. That's what it all comes out. The Security Hospital in Minnesota is a good example. When our committee visited it, most of the legislatures on the committee had never been inside of this place. We walked in, and it was an old, run-down, ramshackle place. And the day we got there, I guess they didn't know we were coming. And there were just one or two guards, and everybody was locked up, and they had to open all the cells individually. There was no master lock. And so that if there were a fire or something like that, they wouldn't be able to get anybody out. So we immediately recommended that they close the place down and move everybody out because of the fire hazard. And the politicians in the area heard about that, and they came and just landed all over us. And consequently, it never did get shut down, and it's still operating. I guess it's been rejuvenated a bit. But in Minnesota, that sounds a little bit negative. We've gone back now and are rebuilding all of our institutions so that they will be like the ones in Sweden that you were talking about, where they're going to be smaller and concentrate on different kinds of problems. And for those people that we don't have any cure for, so to speak, they're going to be in maximum security prison in a brand new one out near the old prison. And they're just more or less going to stay there for a long time, but be treated humanely. And they're going to concentrate on a lot of rehabilitative things just in case.
Yeah, they're doing something new in Washington here for the Del Defender. They're all building a mini prison.
Right.
They have one in Portland, in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
It's 25, and they're trying to build them throughout the state, but there's a tremendous amount of objection to it.
It's pretty expensive.
Well, yeah, they're expensive, but they're not as expensive as the big monstrosities.
Right.
Nobody wants
people themselves don't want them in there
because
they're fearful of the individual.
Right. Yes.
It's kind of interesting because of the setting here to hear some comments from people about, from a Christian point of view, accepting the statement that you really can't rehabilitate people, you just have to lock them up and punish them, and in essence, half of them are going to repeat, there's really no hope. How does that jive with your Christian morality?
I'd like to add just a footnote on that. I heard you also saying, though, that there were some successful ones that were not politically acceptable. So that we may have to throw that in then for the Christian conflict that possibly some of the methods
and the churches were in
successful for treating some of these people don't fit what we normally call our Christian values.
And many church organizations were involved in cutting those out, David.
Yes.
That, right. They, in fact, usually are the leaders in preventing the kinds of changes that would rehabilitate people.
And what?
The churches oftentimes are the leaders in the groups that keep these changes from happening, or semi-quasi-church groups, okay? Now, I suppose we could argue about that all day, but I can name a few examples.
Has Charles Colson started a group and a program for rehabilitating people?
I don't know much about what he's doing. I know what he is.
Going into the prisons teaching Bible study.
Right.
And men are coming to Christ and then they can rehabilitate.
With that statement, what you just said, this past year we talked a lot about a two-statement theology. Here at Holden saying, you know, yes, change me, no, don't change me. And the no, don't change me is like, you know, I don't want you to change me, but say yes to God, let him change me, you know. And I don't think, just because our nature, our old Adam that we live in every day, it's not something I can deal with, but the Christ in me can deal with it. And so in that way, I think that's the only way that there could be rehabilitation for any of us. Because we're all sick, you know. Although we're not in prison, we all need that rehabilitation every day, you know. And so I think that would be the key of how we could rehabilitate all of us.
Right.
But that's what Carl Jung, the psychologist, said. There's two sure cures, and I don't think Ellis discounted that within the 50% who didn't come back, who knows what happened. But Carl Jung says there are two sure cures for sickness, mental sickness, or is love and religion. That can, you know,
yes,
change the picture for a person.
I still think we're avoiding the question that was raised
right
here. because we're saying, well, we'll accept the rehabilitation if it's on our terms. I mean, that's, and you got to realize that some of the lives that these people have led, and their very thought patterns, language, and everything else is quite foreign, I assume.
From
a few people I know, very, very different.
Right.
And when, to reach a person like that, I mean, let's put it right on the line. I mean, if it does involve rehabilitation programs, which you said, like the sex offenders, that are against what are our cultural patterns of behavior, but yet statistically they do say it is successful, where do our values stand there?
Mm-hmm. Would you want your wife or daughter to be the surrogate in one of these programs?
No, but I wouldn't want them to be attacked either.
No.
So, I mean, it's, if it was a choice of the good and the bad, just like that, it'd be easy. But that's the point I think he's raising, is it's not.
What would be easy? I guess you'll
ask. I don't know. There isn't. That's why his question.
The decision is not easy. It's not an easy decision. Yeah.
What was it? Volunteers, those ladies?
Paid.
Paid volunteers.
Yeah, paid volunteers. Yes, right. They generally make their living that way anyway, so that So it's nothing that's not already going on.
So really, society didn't lose anything because these ladies make their living that way anyway. So
but are you treating these people fairly too? Would you want? Would you ask that of somebody that you loved and cared for to participate in that?
That's a good question. I wonder in their.
You mean the prisoner?
Well, I think we got a responsibility to this woman too.
Yes, but if she's out on the street corner anyway.
But she's sick too.
Yes, but
maybe.
So, but were they providing supportive services, medical care, and so forth, or how were they treating the women that were involved in?
I think that was their only involvement. It was a business like arrangement, as I recall.
Just the services. You
just the services, yeah.
But they provided no other kind of service for the.
No, that's normally that's
check the medical.
Right.
Medical.
Yeah. Well, they might have some medical. I'm not sure. I wasn't that close to the program, so I don't know.
Yeah. The churches who are against this have a better solution, or are they just taking the medical?
No, it was just we don't want to do that.
They don't have anything better to do.
No. No, and the real choice they're making is then that that these guys go back out in the street and they rape people.
That really burns me. People just take a negative attitude.
Yeah.
Nothing positive.
It wasn't just churches either. I don't mean to imply that. There were a lot of groups involved, but they were too. And that was in response to the other question. Yeah.
Right. I'd like to report on a positive program and a successful one I've been involved with in the last 3 years. The Pasadena area, and it's called Project Job. I don't know whether you've heard about it or not. Have you heard Project Job?
Go ahead. No, I haven't by name.
It involves a man who spent 17 years in prison, including San Quentin. He got involved in a riot in the prison, and he almost was killed in the riot, and resolved if he ever got out, he would do all he could keep people from going back into prison. It initially started in San Diego and was Project Joe 1 down there, and it was supported by the federal government and was ex-offenders, helping ex-offenders. He then came up to Pasadena area and started his own project. He initially started with, I think, 5 other ex-offenders, and it's a program in which ex-offenders help other ex-offenders. They talk the same language. They know the problems. They can tell when somebody's trying to bluff them or not. And in the first year of operation that they had in Pasadena, the crime rate dropped to 23%. The police and everybody was taking credit for it, but I don't think they realized that normally when somebody comes out of prison and yet is unable to get a job, the first month is critical. And if he isn't able to get it, then he goes back to crime. I think in the first year they had 700 ex-offenders come through their operation. 95% of them at the end of the year were still out of prison, and only 5% had gone back.
Yeah.
What they were doing was sitting down with these people, talking straight to them, and then going out and talking to employers, finding a job for these people, transporting them there, making sure they got there, and then following up a month later to see if they had any problems and getting those straightened out. And they've had a tremendous success rate, and they've been going now 3 years. And as I understand it, ex-offenders from all over have heard about it and funnel in from outside Pasadena in order to go through this program.
That has the characteristics of those programs that I've seen work. Yeah, you have
isn't,
one.
Isn't this AMICUS program in Minnesota?
It's a lot like that. There's the AMICUS is where there's a one-on-one, where a guy like me will meet an inmate in prison and stay with them while they're there and see them every week. I think you have to pledge to see them every week, don't you?
I really don't
Something
know.
Something like that.
I've been interested
and
in
then you follow them up and make sure that they get through their employment process.
Isn't this one of the biggest problems of other than like sex offenders? What that criminal can do once he gets out. The
yeah.
society turns against him, doesn't have a chance
right.
for a job or anything. And it seems to me that one of the most important things that, that the public can do, that we as normal people, let's assume we're normal people, can do is to help these people get some type of employment.
Right. Yeah. In fact, most programs, most systems now are concentrating on that. We have a program in Minnesota for certain kinds of offenders, and again you have to be careful in your screening and things like that, but as someone's getting ready to be released in Minnesota, they go through about a six-week training course on how to get ready for a job and how to obtain a job and all the aspects of how to get a job and how to stay at work and how not to get in trouble and all of those things. And the thing has really been successful in the small groups that it has worked with, and part of it's the key I really think is having someone on the outside to follow up. Because usually about 6 months after they're out, everybody forgets about them. The hard part's the first week or so. Used to be, and it still is in many cases, where they just dump a guy out the door and give him a suit and a couple bucks, and that's about it. I still think that they're doing that in a lot of places, but now they're getting more toward making the arrangements for a long period of time. In fact, I think they're slowly shifting in many states to having at least a two-year period of follow-up services in addition to parole. Parole officers, but in addition to that, supportive services. So when a person gets into a crisis, they can call a hotline and get some help immediately, financial help or counseling of any kind.
Yeah, that program in California is the same one that we saw a documentary on, and have seen the same fellow who started it. When those fellows come to the house or whatever, there is a strict discipline there,
yes.
and they have to accept that very strict regimen in order to stay there, or they won't have it.
This is not a halfway house.
Somebody else then's got a program going.
In California, right.
It started. And that involves a house, and then they actually have their own businesses
right.
for the people.
Yep.
You probably know all about that.
Yeah, well, there's all kinds. That's a halfway house. Even officially, we have established the state prison has established halfway houses in which we let these people go out and stay and live for the last 60 days and maybe 60 days after their paroled, and so they can get a job. The program you described has potential and it has effectiveness. The point I usually make is that in prison there's no rehabilitation. Because prison, and I don't know if I can ever make you understand what it is to be in prison, prison is an unreal world. The only way I can tell you is if you were holding church services in a Greyhound bus station, the people in your service will be there somewhat in body, but they always have their eye on the schedule of the bus when it's coming. They're really suspended in animation. They're not real. People in prison are not real because their reality isn't there. Anything that's meaningful is outside. But in California, we give them all kinds of programs. I have two chaplains and a part-time rabbi for 2,000 men, 15 teachers and a principal, a recreation man, and all the services, psychiatric services, best hospital services. But that doesn't touch them. It keeps them in good health and so forth. Now, this sort of a thing going out in the streets, when they're not under authority, then they're in contact like people, real people, and that touches them, if there's any way of touching them. But when you got them locked up, I know how it is because I was the chief locker-upper, and it's a very destructive problem. If a person has anything beautiful in him, you put him in a prison or a jail, you destroy whatever is beautiful in the person. And at the same time, you add whatever is filthy and dirty, he learns. Because he's more in contact with them lend a half hour that he may have with the chaplain or the psychologist or the psychiatrist. It's the most constructive problem. And the thing that bothers me at this time is that we have no alternative. And one of the things that we have to realize, if I make any point at all, is that we don't understand what to do with these people and we don't have any alternative. Until we accept that fact, we're not going to move too much in really doing something. And I don't know what the answer is.
You know, over the many years I've been with juvenile, as young as 8 years old, used to be in the institution.
Yeah.
And every so often I read the paper about kids I worked with who are now in adult prison. But most of these individuals, I could predict that they would end up there. Because you look in their background, terrible background. You never got to start the world, you know. Inevitable, or something like that. And you haven't been able to reach them, touch them, on the growing up part. And I don't know how in the world an adult institution could ever touch them. Because they're so badly damaged. So we haven't found the key to how to reach them, and how to get into the family. Deal with that, that's where the problem is. But most of these 50% who are repeaters, who are serious, every one of them, you look at their background, that's what they are as they are.
Yeah, but the other thing is,
to
find people who aren't in the prejudice, who have just as rotten background as those people.
Not necessarily. Every individual affected by his environment in a different way. And affects that individual a certain way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's
that
right.
It is not strictly that, because there are a lot of people who, the three kids on either side of them didn't wind up.
But you can't gauge it that way, because that's a different individual. He's affected
exactly,
by
yeah.
That environment.
I remember very clearly a case of, he's a professor of something in Stanford University, had five children. Most of the girls were Phi Beta Kappas or something outstanding. The boy didn't get along with the old man. And the old man had a lot of money, obviously, enough money. And the boy would steal clothes out of the, just simply to embarrass the father. I think that was his dynamism, because he never could get back to the old man. The old man was very successful. He would never reach him. In some kind of an impasse there. And the boy would steal enough that they put him in prison, time and again. And the point he's making there is true. In the same environment, one comes out different. The same parents, lovely parents, I met them, came to see him. And I told him, let me tell you the other story. And I could tell from the father and the mother came to talk to me about the son for transferring to another institution close to someplace. And I could see as they met, as they talked with me for a half an hour, how the father wavered psychically. And to make it more clear to you, the boy, I understood, the boy couldn't relate to him because he turned from hot to cold. Now, you know, you can take a shower if it's too hot, and if it stays hot, you can get used to it, or too cold. But you can't enjoy it too much between hot and cold. And that's the way the old man was. And the boy could never learn to adjust to it. So he rebelled. But the other family, the rest of the family, was okay.
Ma'am, you had a question.
Prevention is still the best, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yep.
That's what we've always worked at.
Right. Yeah, I don't know where that begins. I think it begins very, very early and in families.
And the church has been working with it.
Yeah. The experience I've had there, one personal experience that I had was getting involved in starting a daycare center in association with an inner city plant that we built. And picked up a lot of youngsters out of an area that where, 50 to 60% of the kids that came out of there ended up in a juvenile detention home somewhere. And we've been following up the children that start out as young as 3 weeks old, and some of them, and they stay with us until 12. And I guess there have been enough graduates, 500 or 600 now, that have gone through that process, and not a one of them have had any kind of problem at all. In fact, they not only have not had any negative problems, they've really done very well. And the kinds of experiences that they got in the daycare center was not just care, but it was a very enriched, a positive experience, a curriculum, actually. And not that I'm saying that kind of thing is the answer, but there's a lot of people that think that is the answer. Larry.
part of the effectiveness of this ex-offender program that I'm working with. The ex-offenders are going out to the schools and telling the juvenile people there just very honestly what prison is like.
Yep.
And too many times somebody, an uncle or a brother, comes out and he really doesn't tell it honestly, and he
makes it sound glamorous. Yeah.
And they get the wrong picture. But these people are going out and telling it like it is, and they're really having an effect in school. In yep. addition to that, they're having seminars with the businesses locally in Pasadena, telling them as an offender or an ex-offender point of view how they can protect their own business from rip-off and crime. Right. From their knowledge as criminals, what they go through their business, say, you better fix this, it's easy to be walked off with, yep. or you change this. And so it's a very powerful program.
I think business has a very important role in this, and it really is getting drawn into it. That's how I got drawn into it. In fact, we have a large quota that we hire every year, and we studied how to do that effectively and decided that the only way to do that is to train the supervisors well, as well as prepare the ex-offender. We have a heavy program on training the supervisors and then have a heavy supportive service. And that's where the hotline idea got started. We started a hotline for our ex-offenders and some other kinds of problem employees we have, and it was so successful that all of our employees wanted it, and now we offer it to everybody. And anyone that works for us now, if they have a problem any time, day or night, they can call up and get help. But it started with the ex-offender program. But I began to learn by looking at the kinds of problems that everybody had sometime, that the ex-offender population really wasn't so much different once they got out. About 20% of all of our employees have problems like that, and it seems to be different people all the time. And I think over a 10-year period, almost everybody's got a problem they're going to get involved with. It's something relatively serious.
What company are you with?
Control Data Corporation. Yeah, we've been selling that to them. I think we run that hotline. maybe not. We've been consulting with them. Yeah, that's kind of ironic because I got the idea for setting up the hotline while I was working for the state, and then we got it going. And now we turn around and sell it back to them as a profit-making venture. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
As I sit here, I come up with a very nagging question that it seems to me that there really isn't a great problem with those who really desire rehabilitation, but that there must be a great percentage of them that have no desire for rehabilitation whatsoever. But there are programs available for those who do have the desire for rehabilitation, and your sex offender program provided these fellows with a reward sort of a program, re-education. Now, what do we work with to provide the proper motivation for that type of...
I'm a little bothered by your saying those with the desire need the tool. I think you have to talk about what level of desire is. If a guy was to say, well, yeah, I'd like a good paying job, I'd like to be a doctor, or I'd like to be an auto mechanic or something, he may think that at one level, but society taught him from his environment, what he saw in society, it's so far removed that it doesn't seem a realistic goal. And in fact, it may not be a realistic goal. His attitudes and his life to the time he commits the crime may have been so conditioned that almost any kind of rehabilitation would fail because he has to start all over again with everything, starting with table manners, getting up, going to work, how to talk to people civilly, how to not be bitter about life. So while, like heaven, it may be desirable to him, he has no idea how to get there. So it isn't just a matter of training him to be an auto mechanic, it's training him to be a completely different person. And as you said, it's pretty hard to...
In a way, though, I subscribe to what you have said, because in my general feeling, I come to the conclusion that about 25 to 30% of the people that we have in prisons don't want to go home. Mm-hmm. This is the this is the best life or the most enjoyable life that they could ever have any place now. And that's kind of hard for people on the outside to perceive. But it is true, because I'm sitting there all the time. I have a group of psychotherapy, group of 12 people for a year and a half, and occasionally I tell them, okay, half of you guys are coming back when you go out. No, I don't know which one really is going to be you, or you guys figure it out. But I even tell them point blank, they say, Mr. Vitas, I got 6 more months to go for parole. I says, don't worry about the date of parole, because we're going to let you out when the day comes. You worry about the date when you come back, because that's the date that you got a control over. You don't have an amazingly, I'm still there, and they come back.
You said something the other night, too, Ellis, about the environment. And I think it fits in with what you're saying. They get so conditioned by the prison environment to what they're doing that they really, in a sense, don't have the desire, because they have the desire to stay.
Well,
they're
some meaning inside. They have some meaning, because you ought to see how their faces light up. As people come off the bus here and friends meet them and say, hi, you know, and the people smile. It's exactly the same situation as the bus drives in between gates and these guys pile out. And here's the San Quentin friend. Hi, Joe, what are you doing? And they light up and they're faint.
An official greeter.
Now, that's incredible.
The first time I ran into that.
There is a percentage.
Yeah, a lot of that.
A large, of 25 or more percent. And so why we
so it seems to me like the Christian community could really create that home outside the prison for the person. In terms of welcoming them back to the community, like this Joe program is doing.
But it'd take a long time, you know, as you said, the conditioning is. Yeah, because they've been built into these things for 10, 15 years. Yes, ma'am.
Well, my question was, how willing are, do you have any statistics on how willing people on the outside are to employ ex-offenders, or, you know, and are people really willing to do this, or is this part of the problem?
Well, I employed one about 5 years ago. I interviewed him in the prison. I employed him, and before he came out of prison, at that time was employing about 20 people. I informed everybody in my organization what he was, what he was in for. I informed everybody that, sure now, if anything is missing, he's going to be the first one suspected in that, and I asked everybody to give him every consideration. And this person turned out excellent, actually. He turned out just excellent, and he was one of the best-liked employees for a whole year's time. But then there was no problem with any of the employees. Everybody accepted him, and accepted him exceptionally well. But then, unfortunately, he was in for forgery, and his tendency towards forgery was connected with alcoholism problem, and he had married a second wife, and she was an alcoholic, and she eventually got him back into drinking, and so eventually ended up back in prison. But for a year's time, he was just an absolute excellent employee. We trusted him with hundreds of dollars worth of money at times on his own in my particular kind of business. Worked out just wonderful.
In California, we don't have any trouble finding any jobs. The community takes them. There's no problem. Because we always have to have somebody, some job before a man is sent out. So there's no problem from that angle.
What kind of problem with alcoholism did you find? Did that
the problem of alcoholism, that alcoholism per se first of all, alcoholism fills up the jails, which are not the prisons. And putting the alcoholic in the jail is a pounding sand in a rat hole. That's no process. That's no treatment. That's nothing except you get him off the street. We ought to have some other facility, a medical facility treatment there. But we're not at the point that we want to. And incidentally, the hospitals don't want to take alcoholics because they're a mess to handle. They upset. But in the prison, people come because of alcoholism incidental to their crime, as in this case, you see. They drink and they write checks, or they drink and they hold up somebody, and they drink and it's incidental. And I found, because I made a study myself, about 300 men that we paroled over a year, And when I saw, and I was making an assessment of their success, possible success, because I'd be there, I see them coming back. I found that when I saw alcoholism in the background, I gave them a 50-50 chance, because I don't know which one's going to make it and which one is not going to make it. Alcoholism is a different problem. It's a disease, a chemical disease, and we're doing more to handle it. We have Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a very effective program, because it deals exactly with the same principle as the alcoholic who's been there is telling another guy that's suffering, hey, man, I know what you're going through, but you got to give it up. And the guy looks at the man that's talking to him and says, hey, he was there, and he's doing all right. So, and this is real help, both almost in a religious aspect, because these people are dedicated, and human, as well as effective. And it does help.
Drug and alcohol treatment is becoming a standard. Yeah, that's different. That's harder. I can't think of anyone that I've worked with on the hard stuff that has really successfully pulled out. And that's a small set of cases. But
yeah, of course, the drug problem is confounded by our laws, which have marijuana in the same category. And we had a whole institution in California because of marijuana was it was against the law to have it or to use it. Now I think it's getting better. To mix marijuana with the narcotics, or the heavier narcotics, it's not the same thing. But in society outside, it leads, especially in our children in schools, it leads them to that. It's a stepping stone.
Yes.
Also, I would imagine it's very difficult to find employment for a sex offender.
Find what? Employment?
Employment.
Yeah, that's not easy.
And the other thing I was going to ask is, the only idea I have of prison is what I see on TV or movies. And is it really that grim? You know, you see somebody sometimes in a story to come in for a minor crime, and they're in there a little while, and when they come out, they're really hardened criminals.
Could be.
It's
incidentally, sex offenders make very good workers. Meticulous, clean, and orderly as workers.
Hmm.
And murderers make good workers, too.
Oh, yes. And they tend not to repeat.
They repeat?
Yeah. Their recidivism is the lowest of all.
I don't know about statistics, but that's a powerful recidivism.
Yeah, right. It is such a powerful recidivism.
I remember I had a man that worked in the kitchen. He used to run the kitchen in one of the prisons down south. He killed his wife with a hammer. He was my chief baker. So we paroled him eventually. Murder is about 7 to 12 years. And he went out and I think he committed another murder. He killed another woman.
Oh, I remember the first one murderer my wife met. I had a lot of them as an ombudsman caseload, and one in Minnesota for a while. I don't know if they're still doing it. They began to open up the prisons, and on Saturday night they'd have big parties, and people would come in to the gymnasium, and they'd bring in food and bring in a band, and the inmates could bring in their girlfriends, and they'd dance and all that kind of thing. And so my wife and I were invited to one of those first parties. In fact, it was the first time they had catered food in from the outside. They had McDonald's, hamburgers, and Kentucky Fried Chicken.
How big was the population? How big was the place?
Oh, about 900 to 1,000. And this was the toughest place in the state, too.
Yeah, but you got the select group of about 150 inmates, the whole population.
No, they had divided them up into clubs. And this was I forget what the kind of club it was, but these guys were not on their honeymoon. And we went in there and wandered around, and I was introducing her to people. And one guy was cutting cheese with a great big knife, and he was whomping the cheese, and he's handing it out to people. And I introduced her to him, and he shook her hand, walked off, and I said, that guy stabbed his wife with a knife about 2 years ago. Made her very uneasy. She didn't go back for any more cheese. In fact, he was the same guy I was telling you about, he was part of a three-man team that grabbed a hostage, a guard hostage, and then the other ombudsman, thank goodness it wasn't me, and the warden, or the commissioner of corrections, went in and negotiated getting rid of the guard, but then they went in as prisoners, and they were in there for a long time.
As hostages,
and they finally talked them out of it. My job was to go in there afterwards and talk to this guy and try to figure out what it is he wanted. He was really mad, and no one could figure out why he was so angry. And there was a wire screen, like, not much better than this between us. And his first words to me were something about he didn't like me very well, and if I wanted to, I could come right through that screen and kill you before that guard could get back to you. And I really didn't have much of a fondness for the guy right away, but we found out what he wanted to do and got him moved into another kind of cell block. About a month later, and the guy always terrified me. Every time I saw him, he was a great big guy, and he had violently killed somebody. I think he had stabbed his wife. About a month later, I was sitting in a cell block interviewing a bunch of people, asking them questions, and they were coming, standing in line in front of the table, and the group I had couldn't read or write very well, and I was having to write down what they were saying for them. That's why I was there. Somebody tapped me on my shoulder, and I was kind of busy. I looked around, and here was this big guy that the last time I saw had been between me. There were bars between me and him, and he was out in the open, and the hair in the back of my neck just stood up. You know, oh, you know, I've had it now. But he said, can I help you? And I felt like saying, yeah, you can go away. I found out he'd become a trustee. Somehow he had decided to quit doing all the bad things he was doing, and he was going to be a trustee. And he wanted to help me interview these guys, so we split the line in half, and he cut the time I had to work with him in half. I followed him up for a long time, and he really turned out for over a long period of time, like I think 5 years, hadn't done a thing wrong in prison. He's not going to get out for another 10 years. So he's got no real reason to be good, to get out. He's not trying to get out on parole. And I just think he just got tired of fooling around, like burning out. You mentioned a case, in fact, Ellis.
Well, one of the points that I want to make is that every day that a man sits in prison is a day less that he can sit outside. Not that one, but in the future. The more he learns to be a prisoner, the less he's able to live outside. I remember a case, a young boy, 19, 20 years of age, he was in isolation. That's really gruesome. They call it the whole gruesome cell for punishment in one of our prisons. And he wrote to the director for some reason or another, so I had him on my agenda, and I went to see him. He was a very violent prisoner. I don't remember the exact crime. He killed another prisoner while he was doing time. He's a small guy, but everybody was afraid of him, like a weasel, you might say, in his temperament, but not physically. So he said, so I go to see him, and I think outside of the segregation there, and he said, well, he said, Mr. Sambidis, I want to get out of this hole here. I said, yes. Well, he said, let me tell you the story. So he began to tell me. He said, when I was a boy going to high school, he said, I was the leader of my gang. I had a tough gang. And I did all right because we took care of everybody. And he says, then I got into a juvenile institution in California, and they said, I did all right there too because I had my gang. Then I got on the streets, and then I come back to prison, and he said, I did all right too because nobody crossed my path. I took care of that guy. So he says, but last few days I'm thinking here, and I look at myself as to how I made my world, and that's his words. On the street, I made my world in the gang. That was mine, against the other gang. And so I find myself in a smaller world of a juvenile institution, and there I make my world fighting against the other guys. Then I go to a big joint, and I'm tough, and I have my own gang. And then I come here, and he raised his hell there, so we lock him up. And he says, finally I find that I developed my world into this small cubicle here. This is the world that I made for myself. He says, I know you people can't put me out there. I understand that. And this is what I made, and I want to get out. And I want to get out. All right, yeah, all right. So I listened to him, and he's a renowned case, a troublesome case. The wardens don't want him transferred about. At least that in that institution, they wouldn't put him in what we call the main line, the general population. So I go back to the director and make my recommendations in terms of review of the case, and I say that it is possible that this man may I feel that he may have made the change of mind. I recommend that we transfer him up to Tehachapi, to a medium security institution where his gang isn't, he hasn't developed a gang there, and we'll try him out in there. Well, the director was the kind of guy that was, we grew up together in the business, and so he pushed it. if the brass wouldn't go for it, he would order it. He did order it, and we transferred him up to the Hatchapi, and from there he went to a lesser institution and he made it out in the streets. But that's a rare case of a tough guy. He's not a tough guy because he would have killed anything at the drop of a hand, either inside or outside, especially a cop. But I didn't think he saw Jesus, but that's a conversion that came over him. And he called it. I said, give me 6 months, I understand. I said, I'm going to try and get you out, and don't get too pushy. So we get him out. That's a rare, kind of a rare and exceptional case.